Hi, family of neurology clinicians. We hope you're all hanging in there during this pandemic. It certainly is an unprecedented time of uncertainty and one in which all of us in healthcare are being called upon to educate and care for our friends, family, and neighbors, in addition to our usual neurology patients. In the meantime, recognizing you may need an occasional few-minute break from all things coronavirus, we will still keep delivering neurology-focused podcasts to you every week. Stay well.
Thanks for tuning in for the March 24th podcast. I'm Bob Gross, editor-in-chief of the Neurology Family of Journals. This week's featured interview highlights a talk on Lewy body dementia management. For the other segment, there's a discussion on pathologic tearfulness after limbic encephalitis. Please remember we offer free CME to AAN members for each eligible podcast, and we welcome your feedback at podcast@aan.com.
Hi, this is Matt Barrett from Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia, and today I'm interviewing John Paul Taylor from Newcastle University in the UK. We're discussing the review titled New Evidence on the Management of Lewy Body Dementia that was published in the February 2020 edition of Lancet Neurology. For more about this topic, I recommend listening to the interview with Susan Schneider-Williams from the September 27, 2016 Neurology podcast. In that interview, she discusses her editorial, The Terrorist Inside My Husband's Brain, which relates the experience she and her husband, Robin Williams, had with Lewy body dementia. Let's first start with the title, John Paul. Define Lewy body dementia for the audience, and what's the new evidence to help guide treatment for this condition?
Yeah, thanks for that. So Lewy body dementia, I suppose, is a catch-all term which considers both dementia with Lewy bodies and also Parkinson's disease dementia. And together, they're probably the second most common cause of late life neurodegenerative dementia. Dementia with Lewy bodies, or DLB, probably accounts for about 4-8% of patients with dementia in clinic-based studies. And certainly dementia, we know, is a common outcome long-term for people with Parkinson's disease. Overall, I think very positively, there's been an increase in the number of clinical trials in Lewy body dementia. And consequently, now it's possible to take, I suppose, a more systemized and meta-analytic approach to inform management practice. And there's new evidence for the treatment of symptoms such as the Parkinsonism and the daytime somnolence. However, I think we recognize that there's still significant gaps in our knowledge. For example, there's been few studies which have focused on how to manage the autonomic or sleep symptoms in Lewy body dementia. And certainly, we know that these non-motor symptoms are very evident in advanced Parkinson's disease. And I think we've recognized that we can draw upon the recent evidence base in Parkinson's disease to help inform and pull through to best practice in the Lewy body dementias overall.
Just in your answer, you've already pointed out what I think can be frustrating to patients and their families. There are a number of different symptoms that can occur with and accompany Lewy body dementia. So there's obviously cognitive impairment, but there's other neuropsychiatric symptoms, motor impairment, autonomic symptoms, and sleep disturbances. Can you go through a few examples of treatments for these symptoms for which we have high-quality studies to help guide our management?
Yeah, I certainly totally agree. I mean, I think there's a great deal of heterogeneity between individual patients in terms of symptom expression. And certainly, even within an individual patient, we can see the symptoms waxing and waning and fluctuating over time, which I think it makes it very challenging from a clinician perspective. I suppose thinking about some of the non-cognitive symptoms, specifically neuropsychiatric symptoms, probably the best evidence sits for cholinesterase inhibitors, rivastigmine and donepezil. Although I think disaggregating trial findings into what specific neuropsychiatric symptoms benefit best from these agents, I think still remains a little unclear, and certainly it may be different between DLB and Parkinson's disease dementia. There is increasing evidence recently to support the use of zolzamide as an adjunctive agent for levodopa and motor symptoms in Parkinson's disease, and certainly in DLB. There's been a recent publication of a phase 3 trial which showed some clinically meaningful motor benefits, and the agent seemed to be quite well tolerated. Although I have to say, longer-term evaluation is probably needed to see whether it's got any negative impact on, for example, cognition. Another exciting agent is pimavanserin, which we know is beneficial for psychosis and Parkinson's disease, and this is evidence from the earlier trials. But latterly, there's been a number of double-blind clinical trials in people with dementia and psychosis, which has included both people with DOB and also Parkinson's disease dementia. And I think overall, this is certainly suggesting that this may be an agent of choice given its low side effect profile, although I think one of the issues remains sort of cost and the fact that it's not licensed in many countries.
So as you discuss in the paper, there's a number of treatments for Lewy body dementia that are consensus-based, and it's very likely we're not going to have trials that directly address those symptoms. And sometimes what we use is what we've learned from Parkinson's disease. So tell us about a couple of these consensus-based treatments where we may never have the randomized controlled trials to support our current practice.
So unfortunately, I think given the challenges of conducting trials in Lewy body dementia, we have to pull evidence from other areas and conditions such as Parkinson's disease. I think you picked on the particular area of, you know, getting RCTs in the management of autonomic symptoms such as orthostatic hypertension, urinary urgency and constipation will probably be particularly hard. And this is probably arising out of the fact that, you know, these symptoms are often overlooked in Lewy body dementia. I mean, I do remain quite optimistic that we will get trials on the management of, let's say, sleep disturbances in LBD. For example, it would be great to have a trial of melatonin for REM sleep behavior disorder or stimulant-related treatments for excessive daytime sleepiness or apathy. And I think there's still also room for broadening the repertoire of cognitive enhancers beyond cholinesterase inhibitors. Just thinking about sort of specific examples of autonomic symptoms, one aspect, urinary urgency, which is perhaps a degree underrecognized. You know, one can advocate the use of anticholinergics. We know that these can have a very negative impact upon cognition. And from our Delphi panel, the recommendations such as mirabegron were suggested as reasonable alternatives. Furthermore, as part of our review, we developed a management toolkit, which is freely available online, and the link is provided in the paper, where we looked at managing Lewy body dementia symptoms more holistically. So whilst one might only derive small benefits for treatment in each symptom domain, I think in aggregate, management of all symptoms can probably bring clinically meaningful benefit for patients. And I should add that we're probably looking to report on some findings from an efficacy trial of this toolkit quite shortly.
One of the challenges that can occur with treatment of Lewy body dementia patients is that treatments for one symptom may actually worsen another. You discussed this in your paper. Can you give a couple scenarios that you encounter clinically where this occurs and how you handle these situations?
Yeah, and I certainly mentioned in the previous question the use of anticholinergic agents to treat urinary urgency, which can obviously exacerbate cognitive impairment and confusion. And overall, you know, you hone in on one of the biggest challenges in Lewy body dementia management, and that's why we've tried to take this holistic management approach as part of our review. I suppose one of the archetype examples is dopaminergic treatment for the motor symptoms, which then can exacerbate psychosis or lead to the manifestation of visual hallucinations. And conversely, antipsychotics can have a very detrimental impact on the motor symptoms. So I think that these are fundamental challenges that we face. Overall, what we've sort of suggested is that it's important to consider what problems have a higher priority for treatment and really take into account the views of the patient themselves, the family, the caregivers, maybe rank ordering the importance and severity of the symptoms to decide which ones to treat and then discuss them in terms of the possible benefits and risks. And sometimes we have to reach a delicate balancing act where we might optimize the management of the motor symptoms at the price of perhaps a few extra hallucinations. I think also we've got to be aware intrinsically the fluctuations in Lewy body dementia means that it's not easy in the short term to directly link changes in symptoms with treatment benefits. So I certainly would advocate being patient, taking a long-term perspective and, you know, regularly reviewing our Lewy body dementia patients. Of course, the one other established mantra is certainly making one change at a time and looking at that sort of optimization of the doses so you don't get those unacceptable side effects in other domains.
There's a lot of great points in there. I couldn't agree more that an individualized approach to treatment and a lengthy discussion sometimes with patients and their caregivers about what is most important is definitely critical in treating this patient group. As you mentioned at the very beginning, this is not just a review of all the current treatments, but is also forward-looking. There's a lot more research going on in the field. Are there any areas of research related to treatment that you're most excited about? Are there changes and developments that we should look for over the next 5 years when it comes to treating Lewy body dementia patients?
Yeah, well, I'll start with sort of a more pragmatic and clinical perspective. And, you know, I'm a real strong advocate that we need to improve the diagnosis of Lewy body dementia. That's the most important first step in better management. Undoubtedly, Lewy body dementia is underrecognized. I think, therefore, studies which enhance the opportunities of making the right diagnosis and identifying Lewy body dementia patients will have a major impact on overall treatment of these conditions. I think also, again, pragmatically and from an applied research perspective, I think we need to take a more holistic multi-morbidity perspective in our Lewy body dementia patients. So applied research focusing on the benefits of, let's say, the multidisciplinary team input with movement disorder specialists, geriatricians, psychiatrists, allied healthcare professionals such as physios and speech and language, etc., I think could make real and tangible differences in terms of quality of life for patients with Lewy body dementia. I suppose from a more scientific perspective, thinking relatively broadly, Lewy body dementia has often been quite a late starter in terms of the race with regard to innovation, new treatments. But I think this is to our advantage. We benefit from the fact that we can see where the mistakes have been made in clinical trial development in other dementia subtypes, particularly Alzheimer's, and learn from them. And certainly, I think as well, you know, pathologically, we know that our Lewy body dementia patients frequently have co-pathology, Lewy body related pathology, and also Alzheimer's pathology. So I think Lewy body dementia is going to be very well placed to benefit or leverage from the massive efforts which are happening either in the Parkinson's sphere or Alzheimer's sphere in terms of clinical trial agents, which could be sort of pulled across for defined trials in Lewy body dementia. And I think also we're in a good position for really early intervention trials. We've got a long lead-in time in terms of pre-dementia stage, i.e. in the form of REM sleep behavior disorder, which can antedate the onset of DOB or Parkinson's disease by decades. So we've got an ideal population in which to conduct secondary prevention or disease-modifying trials, I think.
That's all excellent information. The article we've been discussing is New Evidence on the Management of Lewy Body Dementia, and I encourage listeners to look it up. It's in the February 2020 edition of Lancet Neurology. John Paul, thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you.
This is Stacey Clardy. Today I'm talking with Christopher Butler. He leads the Memory Research Group at the Nuffield Department of Clinical Neurosciences at the University of Oxford. We're talking about his paper from the January 24th, 2020 issue of Neurology. The title is Pathologic Tearfulness After Limbic Encephalitis, a Novel Disorder and Its Neural Basis. Thank you for joining us, Chris.
Pleasure.
I love that this paper is beginning to drill down on what is actually happening at the functional level in the brain in autoimmune encephalitis. And by that, I mean, for as exciting as antibody discovery is in the field of autoimmune neurology, your work is a novel approach to what is actually happening and what our patients are experiencing in these conditions. And I think we can't underestimate how important this must be for our patients. I think we try to imagine what they're going through. And certainly they tell us they feel as if they're going crazy during and after these limbic encephalitis attacks. But to be able to really answer for our patients in a meaningful way what is actually happening in their brain, this is so valuable. So my first question is, what inspired you to do this study? Was this based on a clinical observation of tearfulness in these patients, or was it something else?
Yeah, absolutely. It was clinical observation, as most of the most interesting things in science do come from. I remember particularly one man in his late 50s who had previously always been very healthy and very proud and strong chap, who after his illness, several months after his recovery, told me that he would find himself in tears, sometimes just whilst watching the news or watching a film, which he had never been like beforehand. He told me that he had seen a piece about a baby koala losing its mother. And even as he reported that to me, his voice cracked and tears came in his eyes. So it was a really very striking phenomenon. And so I then began to ask other patients who had had limbic encephalitis about whether they experienced the same sorts of things. And it was a remarkably consistent story across patients. Not everyone described it, but certainly when we asked them to just say yes or no, about 50% of patients described becoming more readily provoked to tears than they had been beforehand by relatively minor triggers, such as movies, often music, seeing someone overcoming adversity, for example. Even on one occasion, someone whose cat had brought them a little present of a dead bird and laid it at their feet in a sort of cute way. So these are very, very minor triggers in people who previously had no history necessarily of any mood disorder.
That's a great observation.
you know, sometimes I think we might think that it's really just depression after, you know, the traumatic event of autoimmune encephalitis, but it struck you that this was really a particular component of what we might lump into depression. Is that right?
Well, so these patients who were describing this to me said that they clearly were not depressed. They did not feel any of the standard symptoms of depression. So anhedonia, you know, problems with sleep, difficulty with appetite, any of those symptoms. And in fact, in our patients, we very carefully measured symptoms of depression and found absolutely no relationship between the symptoms of pathological emotionalism, this easily triggered tearfulness, and sort of cardinal symptoms of depression. So although clearly patients who've had limbic encephalitis can become depressed, as indeed many patients with other brain disorders can as well, there seems to be no relationship between the two. So this does not seem to be a primary mood disorder.
Important distinction. So let's get to the study. In your study, you surveyed 38 patients, an average age of 63 years old, in what you call the post-acute phase of autoimmune limbic encephalitis. And you had them complete questionnaires about emotion regulation, as you just alluded to, and then complete a structural functional MRI. And you compared all of those subjects to age and sex-matched healthy controls. So in 28 of the 38 patients, you said an antibody was identified. None of them were NMDA receptor encephalitis, I think. So what were the antibodies that were identified?
So the majority of patients had LGI1 antibodies. I think there was something like 20 of the total had LGI1. A few had Caspar-2 antibodies. And there were a couple of GAD antibody patients. There was one with a paraneoplastic anti-MAR2 antibody. And there were some who had been diagnosed with limbic encephalitis prior to the introduction of LGI1 and Caspar-2 assays. And the antibody that was detected in them was just the voltage-gated potassium channel complex antibody with no further subtyping possible.
So you've really been at this study for a long time then, if it's pre-LGI1, Caspar-2. And I think you also said about 10 of them didn't have a known antibody again at the time, but they clearly fulfilled the Grouse criteria for autoimmune encephalitis. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Right. And about half of your 38 patients, I think, had pathologic tearfulness. So tell us about their functional MRIs. What circuits were different in those patients with the pathologic tearfulness?
Okay, so we looked at this in two ways. We divided the patients into those who complained of it and those who didn't. And we also did correlation analyses between various clinical factors and the score on a questionnaire about emotional tearfulness. So we found that patients who had this tearfulness had really three major changes in their brains. First of all, we found volume loss in the right anterior hippocampus. Now, obviously, the right anterior hippocampus, as with the left hippocampus, are targets of the disease process itself. But this particular part of the right anterior hippocampus seemed to correlate with their emotionalism, but did not distinguish between any other clinical features or neuropsychological features that we could detect. So there was no difference between those of patients who had emotionalism and those who didn't in terms of their memory or their executive function or other neuropsychological features. So there's this interesting feature in the right anterior hippocampus, and we know that there are relationships between the hippocampus and emotional processing, predominantly, in fact, from animal literature, but also we know that in certain psychiatric conditions, the hippocampus can be atrophic. Then we found that that particular part of the right anterior hippocampus had functional connectivity with the posterior medial cortex. So that would be the posterior cingulate, the retrosplenial cortex, and the precuneus. And in patients who had pathological emotionalism, the right anterior hippocampus was effectively not talking as well to these parts of the posterior medial cortex. And the precise way that this influences emotionalism, we're not sure about, but we know that those parts of the posterior medial cortex are very important for contextualizing experience, for perspective taking when we experience things in the world. So we've hypothesized that this may be something to do with becoming overly involved in experiences that one is going through rather than being able to sort of stand back and look at them objectively. But that's the hypothesis that remains to be tested. And then finally, we found abnormalities in the much more sort of basic processing regions in the cerebellum and in the ventral pons. So in lobule 6 and lobule 7 cross 1 of the cerebellum and in the ventral pons, we found changes in volume and in functional activity. And we know that these areas are important for emotional regulation from other conditions and from functional imaging studies in healthy people In fact, this area in the ventral pons, there's a couple of case reports out of patients who've had focal strokes in this area and have developed emotional dysregulation in the form of pseudo-bulbar affect, which is perhaps a similar syndrome. So we get areas in the hippocampus, we get areas of connectivity between the hippocampus and the posterior medial cortex, and we get these cerebellar pontine regions, which we know are involved in emotional regulation and are connected functionally to the limbic system as well.
You made the analogy to pseudobulbar affect. Along those lines, in thinking about our patients, do you have any ideas for specific medications that might help these patients based on the affected neural network you've described? I know this is getting a bit beyond the study, but how do you treat these patients now?
No, sure. So we don't think this is the same as pseudobulbar affect, but certainly there are elements of it that seem to cross over. So it would seem reasonable to try similar medications. Here in the UK, some sorts of medications which are available elsewhere in the world for treatment of pseudobulbar affect are not available. So we have tried to use antidepressants, both tricyclics and SSRIs in our patients, and some have indicated that this has improved their symptoms. But there's no evidence yet, you know, obviously from clinical trials, and that is yet to be further investigated. But I would say that one of the most important things at this stage is to recognize these symptoms and to be able to reassure the patients that these are part of the syndrome and it doesn't reflect an underlying mood disorder, and that we are beginning to understand the neural basis of them and how potentially in future there may be specific treatments for them. So I think that element of reassurance and explanation is critical.
Oh, absolutely. And are the changes permanent, or are you seeing slow recovery of these pathways?
So we haven't done any longitudinal analyses yet. Asking patients about it, we don't get any hint that they are improving over time. And in fact, in some patients, there seems to be an indication that these changes in the brain, at least, are not present immediately after the illness. Of course, there are changes in the limbic system, but some of these functional connectivity changes actually seem to develop in the weeks and months after the initial impact of limbic encephalitis. So some things may be sort of subsequent to sort of Wallerian degeneration or some form of disconnection syndrome that develops later on down the line. So it's possible that although you've taken an initial hit with the acute phase of the limbic encephalitis and that's been treated, some of these symptoms may in fact be things that develop as the network changes after the initial hit. But that's slightly speculative.
That's helpful to me. That's something then that I need to watch for more in the follow-up clinic appointments, maybe after all the acute management is done, to start really honing in on this. Do you see any other cognitive or emotional changes? Are you looking at something more for the future?
Absolutely. We've done quite a lot of work on the cognitive changes after limbic encephalitis, and that's a very different story and very interesting. We've published on that, but there seems to be a very focal deficit with memory, and other cognitive functions do seem to recover. So that's encouraging. We're interested in looking at pathological emotionalism outside of limbic encephalitis as well in other conditions. We suspect that it's not isolated to this condition and may be present in other things as well, particularly things affecting the medial temporal lobes, such as temporal lobe epilepsy.
Yeah, that actually leads me to another question. So would it be an oversimplification if I'm trying to predict who might get this in my clinic to look at their MRI? And if, for example, I see right hippocampal atrophy, is that maybe a clue to make me think about it more? Or is that totally oversimplifying and trying to put this down to clinical MRI findings?
So I don't think that, from our data at least, that clinical MRI eyeballing of the volume of the right hippocampus is likely to be helpful in predicting which patients are going to get that. There's not really a dichotomy. There's quite a lot of overlap. So I think it's much more about the dynamic network changes that happen rather than any particular focal region of the brain that's determining this.
Understood. Well, thanks again for talking with us today about your work. The paper again is Pathologic Tearfulness After Limbic Encephalitis, A Novel Disorder and Its Neural Basis. That's in the January 24th, 2020 issue of Neurology. I will certainly appreciate being able to reach for this paper with my patients in clinic. I really look forward to telling them that you've begun to figure out why they're experiencing this. I think that will be a great source of reassurance. And I look forward to more of your work in the future. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks very much.
Just a quick reminder, for a clearinghouse of neurology-related information on the coronavirus, go to the main page of the American Academy of Neurology and click on the coronavirus link to stay up to date.
This is Bob Gross again. Please check out this week's journal, which features an article on how race and ethnicity influences outcomes in young adults with supratentorial intracerebral hemorrhage, and another article highlighting how a simple MRI score aids prediction of dementia and cerebral small vessel disease. Please take a look at these and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.